Welcome to this month's City Talks. My guest this month is Tony Travers, Professor Tony Travers of the London School of Economics. He's also Director of the British Government at the LSE and Co-Director of LSE London. He's an author of several books on London over the last few decades, and his most recent book is London's Boroughs at 50, and we're going to spend a bit of time talking about the book, but also I think what it means for where we are on the city region and devolution agenda more broadly across England and indeed Wales and Scotland. So I suppose the first point, Tony, from reading the book is I got a sense that you're quite a fan of the London boroughs as an idea and as an institution and organisation. Is that fair?
No, I think it is fair, actually. I mean, it's worth remembering, you know, whether you're from or in London, working or based in London, or in any of the other cities across the country, that this reorganisation, which took place, the one that created the boroughs, which took place under 1963 legislation but coming in effect in 1965, although we didn't know it at the time, and it's not often looked like this, was a sort of prototype for creating the metropolitan districts that came 10 or 9 years later in 1974, and they're still with us too. And they're also really the prototype for unitary authorities, which are most of them cities now. So for Leicester or, you know, almost any of the other unitaries, Nottingham, around the country. And what they were was, of course, themselves an evolution in some ways of the municipal corporations or the big city, all-purpose big city county borough type councils, which had existed since the 19th century. But in effect, when this system was introduced from 1965, the boroughs were the primary unit of local government, so a most purpose authority, but with a city-wide system put over the top of it, covering about, you know, 600 square miles of city. And although nobody thought of it in this way at that time, and to some level it's taken Greater Manchester to push this agenda forward, it was a sort of prototype city region.
Yeah.
Because it's called a region for UK statistical purposes. But the truth is, it's just a built-up area. It's a city. So it was a prototype city council, but it's intriguing looking at it in the context of what's going on in Manchester and West Yorkshire and elsewhere in Merseyside now, to see that although it wasn't really seen as a prototype city region, it was.
Yeah. And obviously, the boroughs came in 1965, legislation in 63. Just tell us a little bit about what was happening in order in the run-up to 63 that really the decision for quite wholesale, I think, change, which is unusual in many respects in the way that we deal with institutions in the UK historically. What was happening in the run-up? Why was it that come 1963 that this issue really needed to be grappled with and dealt with?
Well, I mean, 1963, 4, 5, so when, you know, when the boroughs were being created and then started, was also, and not entirely coincidentally, I suspect, you know, the beginning of the modern world we know. I mean, this was the world of, you know, the Beatles and, you know, the Labour government that took office in 1964 revolutionised social legislation in Britain, and lots of new housing was being built at the time to replace slums, which were seen as, you know, really bad in many British cities. So it was at a time of big social change. There had been pressure, really going back to the 1920s, to do something about the built-up area of London, because before 1965, London was governed by the London County Council and a number of smaller so-called metropolitan boroughs inside that area. But by 1965, the London County Council really only amounted to a quarter of the built-up area of London. There were lots of places that were in Essex and Kent and so on, outside London. So there wasn't a city-wide government, no coordinating mechanism. And so it was seen, there'd been a lot of academics, including, interestingly, predecessors of mine at the LSE, notably a man called William Robson, who was had been a protege of Sidney and Beatrice Webb's and Webb and the Fabians. And he and others had been pushing for a reform to London government to create bigger and more powerful units of government at the local level, but crucially, a city-wide government as well, a metropolitan government covering the whole of the built-up area. They'd been lobbying for this certainly since the 30s, but probably even before that. And eventually, in the best traditions of Britain's slow-moving government, the Macmillan government decided to hold an inquiry. They set up a royal commission under a lawyer called Sir Edwin Herbert, and it reported in 1960, and on the basis of that, by 1963, legislation was ready, and we created what became, and again, although it wasn't known at the time, almost the blueprint for subsequent metropolitan and other reforms across the country.
Yeah. As I understand it, there was more than one option available in terms of how this reform might go. I think the number is there was a suggestion there may be up to 50 or 51 local authorities to make up this broader area. So I get some reflection on the options. But I think what was also intriguing in the book was that the ultimate decisions were, as many things have been over the history of London, were informed by and influenced by what the City of London Corporation did or didn't want to see happen. So give us a sense of the options, but then how the City of London Corporation played its hand in all of this.
There's no question, if you look at the map of London, it looks like a jigsaw. I mean, it's 33 separate local authorities. And most unusually, even the city centre in London is not all run by one council. Now, intriguingly, that's also true in Manchester.
Yes, it is.
It's very unusual by international standards. If you're in New York or in Paris, you'll find the whole of the central business district will be in one administration. Hmm. Not so in London. Now, how is that? Well, the main reason is that the City of London, the ancient City of London, the Corporation of London, which is still effectively a London borough but with more powers, has resisted reform every time there's been an effort to reform London's government pretty well. Well, back into the mists of time, remembering that the city already had a form of its own self-government when William the Conqueror turned up in 1066. It had already, as an Anglo-Saxon institution, gained those powers. And William the Conqueror gave the City of London its own charter for self-government. And that was then reinforced by Magna Carta a bit later. And it meant the City of London had a very powerful sense of its own image. It was a trading centre, but also self-governing local authority, municipality. You know, it's interesting to note that the City of New York's government is based on the City of London's original form of government. So because of this unique, long-existing form of government and the way in which it was formed, giving livery companies and others a role in it and having a mayor, then a Lord Mayor, it always protected that that self-governing power and all the things that went with it. It had its own resources, it had its particular way of doing things, and the last thing it wanted was to have its boundaries moved out as the city began to grow round it. So as London sprawled around the ancient City of London, first down to Westminster and then into Southwark and into Tower Hamlets down the river, the city resisted moving its boundaries.
That's quite unusual, though, wouldn't you say? I mean, I would have thought that, you know, the temptation for politicians always is to acquire more power and more resources, particularly as they see what they regard as their common activity expanding out. They want to chase it. Why were they so resistant to that expansion?
I think the City of London was resistant because it had particular wealth of its own. It had particular, as I say, traditions and methods of self-government, which I think they'd always feared, if they were expanded, would get lost into a much bigger area, which would be less easy for the existing people in control to run it. And of course, London did grow very fast around the city. Even, you know, by the time of Elizabeth I, it was growing quite fast. And then in the Georgian era, much faster again. And by the time the railways came, sprawling enormously. So as the city resisted, what happened was that in the surrounding areas, you get parish government, shire government, boards of guardians, odd things set up by Parliament on an ad hoc basis, paving commissions. It was a mess. And that meant it was very hard to govern the sprawling metropolis of London, which had emerged by the middle of the 19th century, That means very poor water supply and sewage systems, and eventually such environmental detriment that, you know, Parliament famously, the great stink, Parliament couldn't sit on the riverside, no. or you know, it couldn't sit on the Thames side or of its own buildings. And consequently, this created pressure in Parliament to set up a joint board, the Metropolitan Board of Works, to deliver infrastructure for London.
Which you interestingly note in the book was not democratically controlled in any serious way.
Absolutely. It was a classic British institution, recognisable to anybody in local government in any city in Britain who's ever set up a joint committee with some of their neighbours. Because it was, although Parliament created it, the members of this Board of Works, and the name's also interesting, it was a Board of Works, the members were drawn from all the parishes and groups of parishes in the City of London as an indirectly elected authority.
Yeah.
Having said that, anybody who lives in or visits London and sees an occasionally well-built straight road like the Embankment or Shaftesbury Avenue, straightish, or uses, as most of us do, whether we know it or not, the sewage system, these are all the legacies of the Metropolitan Board of Works and its chief engineer, Sir Joseph Bazalgette. That lasted from 1855 to 1888-89, at which point there had been some scandal. It was effectively replaced by a directly elected London County Council. 10 years after that, smaller metropolitan boroughs created to form a district council version of local government within the London County Council. And from these building blocks and the area that then grew outside that, you get in 1965 bringing together of pre-existing authorities into today's boroughs.
And one of the big questions, I think, actually, on the Metropolitan Board of Works, it'd be interesting to get your reflection as to whether a modern-day variation or equivalent was actually the London Docklands Development Corporation in a slightly different way, but come back to that. So, come 1965, I mean, one of the big questions I think you talk in detail about in the book is how far out should London and the boroughs extend? How far into Middlesex? How far into Kent? How far into Essex? How far into Surrey? And there were some decisions that were made that, you know, essentially carved bits and pieces out. But how was that process both gone about and then resolved? I guess, was there much resistance from Kent and from Essex and from Middlesex to this, what they saw as, I suppose, the ever-expanding London?
When it came to creating 1963 London, or not what became the boroughs in 1965 and the GLC, there was clearly a debate about how big an area to look at. Well before 1965, bodies such as the London Passenger Transport Board, which became London Transport, operated over a much bigger area than the London County Council and formal London, as indeed did the Metropolitan Police. So the Royal Commission, the Herbert Commission, that sat between 1957 and 1960, looked at an area of probably 850 square miles around London, so much bigger than the London that we know today.
Yes.
So including places that are as far away from central London as Guildford or Crawley, though well within the area that new towns were either considered or being built in at the time, and there was a lot of that kind of thing going on or being discussed at the time. And in the end, the Royal Commission made proposals, which the government then modified somewhat, but it did leave areas on the edge of the proposed Greater London, which most definitely didn't want to go into Greater London. And in particular, there were areas such as Reigate and Banstead and Epsom and Newell in Surrey, and there were others on, you know, the Middlesex, as it then was fringed, the sort of Hertfordshire, Buckinghamshire fringe, as it would be today.
Places like Watford as well,
exactly. But particularly Epsom and Newell, Reigate and Banstead, one way or another, were taken out of London at various points between the government's proposals and the final decisions. And indeed, the final changes to the London boundaries or where London was were made in the House of Lords, which is, if you look at the map of London today, there's a slightly odd-looking peninsula, which is Kingston upon Thames.
Yes.
What that tells you is that there would have been authorities on either side of it, but they were removed at various points.
It's a fascinating but, and again, has very contemporary issues around what constitutes London, and particularly when we think about transport and we think about housing, you know, thinking about Watford or thinking about Epsom Mule or thinking about Reigate and Banstead, all, by the way, are in the centre of the city's definition of London, which is a built-up area. It's very difficult to think about those issues in those places without putting them into the Greater London context.
Yeah, and you can see when the city regions that are now being formed in other parts of the country are thinking about who to bring in, who not to have in. You know, you find Holton, which is a unitary authority in what was, well, it used to be part of Cheshire, a unitary authority, taken into the Merseyside city region. Yes. So these things are not only arguable, but negotiable.
Yes, not quite. I want to talk a little bit about, get you to talk a little bit about London in 1965. In a sense, many of the conversations about London essentially go back a couple of decades, no more, and then really talk about it being a booming place where firms and industry is ever expanding, where population is ever expanding, where the need for more infrastructure, more things, is just the run of the course. But of course, you remind us in 1965, that was definitely not the case. London was declining, and was more than not only declining, it was felt that it was going to continue to decline. And actually, one of the jobs for the boroughs would have been to think quite seriously about how they deal with less people and less firms and less demand for services. So just give us a sense as to, you know, what that 1965 scenario and situation looked like. And then you can almost see that begin to change, well, through the first half, a consistency. But then certainly as we get into the 1980s and particularly 1990s, that quite dramatically changes, isn't it?
You're absolutely right. The early part of London's, this version of London's existence from the 60s onwards, was against a very different backdrop, most easily seen by looking at feature films made at the time. You know, London was a soot-blackened place with bomb sites. It had a population that was falling. It had fallen since, actually, more or less since 1939 with evacuation, you know, from then all the way through, and it was continuing to decline. And more than that, public policy was encouraging it to decline.
Yeah.
There were industrial policies and then office limiting policies, which effectively tried to spread economic activity away from London and the South East, in fact, and the Midlands, interestingly, Birmingham and West Midlands as well.
Yeah.
I mean, and to try to push economic activity, particularly to the north of the country. And anyway, there were lots of town planning arguments for thinning out London. You know, too many people living together in slums, terrible of rented housing. There'd been a report, the Milner-Hull report, about Rackmanism, evil landlords in London in the 50s and 60s. So there were lots of reasons for thinning London out, moving people away. You know, the GLC, when it came into existence, built holiday homes for pensioners on the south coast and in Colwyn Bay, I think.
Yep.
You know, so it sort of, it was a very different world.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. For the first years of London, there was a lot of slum clearance and rebuilding of the kind of towers and concrete new housing that we all recognise and associate with this time. But the population was falling, so that by the mid to late 70s, it was heading towards under 7 million. And the GLC was working on the assumption it might fall eventually below 6
million.
Below 6 million,
million, yes.
So yeah, it was a very different kind of place, therefore relatively easy to pick up property, so unlike today when it's very hard. Anyway, so you've got this early period of decline, but with quite a lot of rebuilding of housing, building of roads, of course, that's the other thing. Roads were seen as buildable in those
days. As the saviour, and as you mentioned in some respect, in the same ways they were in New York at the time, and the battles between Moses and Jacobs and others, in a sense, bringing huge motorways almost right into the centre of London, and then having these orbital ring roads and such, which the West Way was a failed an attempt. But yes, I think you make great points about if that had been allowed to pass, London would have been quite dramatically and physically different.
It would have, more of it was built in some other British cities. Mm. I mean, famously in Birmingham.
Indeed.
You see much more of it in Birmingham, a certain amount in Glasgow.
Yeah.
Got nearer to the city centre and more of it, and indeed in many American cities. The London boroughs, one of the things they did, they didn't all fight massive social housing estates. Some did, many didn't.
Yeah.
But they almost all were very unenthusiastic about these great big new roads, the so-called motorway box, and many of them fought hard to stop them and eventually won. So this was a very unusual first period, really from the mid-60s all the way to the mid-70s, late 70s. Then you pick up a period which can't be entirely disentangled from the industrial decline London was suffering, because, you know, between 1960 and 1980, all the remaining docks shut in London.
Yeah.
And this industrial change, political change in Britain as well, led to the arrival in the late 70s, mid to late 70s, of the beginnings of what we come to know as the New Left.
Yes.
So a new radical left-wing kind of councillor, not in all the boroughs, but in some, who were just waiting for their opportunity. When along came Mrs. Thatcher, elected as Prime Minister in 1979, who wanted to roll back the frontiers of the state, cut local government spending, not, it must be added, by anything like as much as the present government has, but that's another matter.
Yes.
And therefore we end up with a period from the late 70s, about 1980 onwards, through the 80s to 1990, of a kind of running battle, an ideological war between many of the London boroughs, but also councils such as Liverpool,
yes,
Sheffield and others, and the Thatcher government. What we know now about that is, not only did in the end the Thatcher government win, but that had an effect on the contemporary Labour Party in cities,
yes,
which we'll come back to, but it's a very, very interesting impact. From the 1990s onwards, you know, John Major becomes Prime Minister, reconciliation with local government, Labour councils decide to change in many cases, new Labour leaderships, and then you get the rebuilding in London of population starts to rise, and the after the Big Bang deregulation in the city, the beginnings of the creation of the modern global city version of London, which by the end of that decade, and certainly from the election of the Blair government onwards, becomes a place that's growing so fast, with then from the late 1990s onwards very high levels of international immigration, that turns it from being this declining place that the boroughs had inherited in the 60s to one when the boroughs are struggling to house even the existing population,
yeah,
still less all the new people who are in a new population. So it's an incredible transformation to the point today that people worry, you know, they ask the question, is London too big? Is London too powerful economically?
I think one of the interesting things you talk about in the book is such the differences between the boroughs. And you make this point that, you know, boroughs that are conservative in one part of London or indeed next to each other can often be quite radically different, and they're not necessarily a guide from one to the next. Why is the composition and the differences so marked, particularly when the boroughs were formed in 65? They were often the amalgamation of smaller parishes that had differences themselves, and yet, you know, Barking and Dagenham, Kensington and Chelsea, Holborn, St Pancras and Camden, is that
was in St Pancras and Hampstead.
Hampstead.
Which is currently,
yeah,
there's movement there to detach Hampstead even as we speak.
Indeed, I know, in Haringey you've got this sort of very juxtaposed position between Wood Green and Highgate as well. It's a kind of, why have these differences endured? Because I think they still endure today, don't they?
They do very much. One of the intriguing things about writing the book, really, isn't that I hadn't really thought it through before. I mean, it's almost as if each of these boroughs has a personality.
Yeah.
And that'd be true about, you know, metropolitan districts or councils elsewhere. But seeing them so close together, you do realise they have a kind of personality. Now, why is this? Well, it's partly because, as I quote in the book, Michael Hebert, who worked at Manchester University and is now at UCL, a former colleague of mine, actually, he identified in an earlier book that he'd written that if you go into London boroughs, again, this is almost true of all councils, you see a map on the wall of the council area as if it were an island, as if it was sea lapping on all sides of it. And of course, inevitably, that's how councils would work, because you know, if you, again, put it rather crudely, if you're going to decide where to put your very best library, you put it nearer the middle of the borough,
yes,
because more people in the borough will see it and visit it, and it's just easier.
Yep.
And if you are putting some kind of waste-munching plant, you might well put that on the edge,
yes,
and so on. So there are kind of political you know, theoretical political reasons for why this is true. The way councillors are elected and the way they look at their area, they don't look at the area over the boundary unless there's something very bad going on there they don't like.
Yeah.
So there are good reasons why within any local authority the councillors and the leadership think of the area. But that doesn't quite explain why, as it were, Westminster Conservatives and Kensington and Chelsea Conservatives or Camden Labour and Islington Labour are kind of different from each other within a political party.
Indeed.
And, I mean, some of it is history, of course. You know, it is to do with the different kind of people who lived in the predecessor authorities. Something to do with the nature of the people who settled there from other parts of the United Kingdom. Islington, you know, as a borough, was always a fairly radical place politically because it was outside the City of London and had been where radical preachers and political agitators had gone, you know, to ply their trade when you couldn't do it inside the ancient city.
Yeah.
Gave Islington a long-term tradition, slightly different to other London boroughs and so on. So, but they are different. There's no question they're different. You know, the fact is that four of them decided to go for a directly elected mayor and the others didn't.
No.
And that, again, shows you how variegated authorities, which from an outside perspective you might think were all similar. The outer-inner difference might be thought to be more obvious. The outer London boroughs originally were largely suburban.
Yeah.
And many of them in those days were very conservative voting, whereas the inner London boroughs were disproportionately Labour voting and tended, when they were created in the 60s, to be relatively poorer.
Mm.
Intriguingly, that's almost reversed subsequently, that inner London is now richer, in some cases much richer, and outer London has become more like inner London used to be, and you can see that reflected in voting and in the population makeup of many of the outer London boroughs, such as Enfield and Croydon and Redbridge, which are remarkably different today than anything that would have been recognisable in the 60s.
Yeah. And you've referred a couple of times in your reflections on the GLC. Just say a little bit more about how the GLC, the nature of the organisation and its relationship to the boroughs.
I mean, the GLC, like the boroughs, was created at a time of a much bigger belief in the scale of government.
Mm.
You know, it was in the early to mid-60s, after a period of relative consensus between Labour and the Conservatives, Buckskillism and all of that, mass house building by a Conservative government in the 50s and so on. And so the LCC was a big organisation, the GLC's predecessor over a smaller area. When the GLC was created, it kind of became like a much bigger version of the London County Council, but it was big and it employed very large numbers of people, thousands of people.
Yeah.
Because by the time the GLA was created in 1999-2000, start work in 2000, even under a Labour government, Blair government, it was very much at a time when we believed in contracting out and, you know, privatisation and smaller government. Government was no longer expanding all the time. And so, you know, ministers who were responsible for creating the GLA, the Mayor and Assembly, Nick Rainsford, most observably the case, this would be true for him, you know, wanted to create something which had a small core staff, which was entirely strategic. Now, it would have, you know, Transport for London and the Metropolitan Police and the Fire Authority as sort of big subsidiaries, but the core would be tiny. And the core remains, it's bigger than it was in 2000, but it's still pretty tiny. And if you compare the City Hall bureaucracy, which has to do strategic planning, with the Transport for London as an institution, then, you know, TfO is a much bigger organisation.
No, quite.
So the GLA, as compared with the GLC, bear the mark of their creation. But this reminds me of something else which, you know, anybody who's interested in city government might want to look up. In writing the book, I came across a number of beautiful films made by the boroughs about their own past, but one of which, made by Hounslow, I particularly liked. And the Hounslow film, easily found online, saw the borough as like a mini welfare state.
Right.
Doing all sorts of things for people, for their families, for older people, and everybody. It also includes a particularly of its time moment when the voiceover says, the council is committed to modern financial management and has bought a computer. And this computer, which looks about the size of a mini, has been winched on a crane into the side of the building. But there's no doubt that Hounslow, and I'm pretty sure most of the other boroughs, saw themselves — this would have been true, I think, of the metropolitan districts when they were created 9 years later — as, you know, mini versions of the British state, a kind of mini welfare state. And that, we're a long way beyond that these days.
And the modern, what we'll have in, as you say, in Greater Manchester and Greater Sheffield and West Midlands, North East, this sort of strategic combined authorities, they call, but the strategic authority, very much modelled, into at least in terms of size and nature of operation, towards the GLA rather than the GLC, which I think, you know, you would endorse as the right balance between, I think, what you describe in the book is a London being unique for its bottom heaviness in terms of much of the power, much of the resource, much of the responsibility sits with the boroughs, and there are obviously 33 or 32 in the corporation, which is unlike, as you said, Tokyo or Paris or New York, where the strategic authority operates at a bigger scale and is much more significant than the boroughs of New York, for example, which are relatively impoverished, really.
There's no doubt that the London model from 1965 onwards, but particularly from 2000 onwards, is, you're right, I described it as a bottom-heavy two-tier system. Mm. And what's interesting about that is that, and it's not unique to London within Britain, you can very much see this in the city regional models, as you rightly say, that are being developed elsewhere. Of course, all of us, if you think about it, we all have an interest that is local. That is, you want the local council to be able to make sure the streetlights work and to stop nuisance and to represent really quite local interests. But we also have interests that are metropolitan. Mm-hmm. We want fast trains, we want good trains and trams, we want roads, we want police forces. None of these things can cross, you know, these all have to, they can't stop at borough boundaries or authority boundaries. So, in a sense, a two-tier system of the kind we have in London, but is being evolved in a rather different way in the other city regions in England, and actually now in Wales and Scotland as well, in Cardiff and Glasgow. You know, it does, I think, rather well articulate the fact that all of us have different needs. You know, as I said elsewhere, we all want to have a bus stop or a train station or a tube station close to our home, but not too close.
No.
You know, we want it to be near,
yes,
but not very near. We want the council to stop what we imagine as the trouble that might come with having it too close to our home, but we want the citywide authority to build it just that bit further away.
Quite. Yeah.
And that's, yeah, and that I think is a legitimate political argument.
Yeah.
And the two-level system can articulate the debate between those apparently inconsistent needs.
And I thought was fascinating in the book the insights you bring to actually saying in many respects that the London boroughs, individually and collectively, or not necessarily all of them, were mediating influences really on the GLC, particularly when it was in full throw around this major road building program that we've touched on, and their demand for large scale housing, and particularly big housing estates, either in London, and then they were almost the mediating influences to try and control and constrain some of those metropolitan ambitions, I suppose, in some respects, which people often miss, because that can also get quite easily labelled as NIMBYism, can't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, famously in the United Kingdom, we don't do constitutions.
No.
But you could argue that a two-level system like this in a city is an implied constitutional settlement, where the local areas act on occasion as a check on the power of the city-wide government, and the city-wide government on occasion will drive through things the smaller areas don't want. And what's interesting for me about the city-regional models that are emerging in the rest of the country now is that they're coming up with their own different versions of a settlement of this kind, generally trying to fuse together, and certainly the Greater Manchester model does this, is to kind of fuse together a collective leadership of the 10 districts and the new mayor, which is a different way of handling a similar issue. And, you know, it will be interesting to see when the directly elected mayor in Greater Manchester and elsewhere has their own mandate after 2017. Yeah. Whether it continues to work in exactly the way it's now imagined.
Yes.
We'll park that thought for
day. Quite. I mean, we'll come back to this, I suppose, at the end. But what do you have a sense that the balance is, I suppose, there's never a right to balance, but is the balance broadly where you think it ought to be in London at the minute, between the boroughs on the one hand, individually and collectively, increasingly through London councils, which I think has become an increasingly important collective for the authorities, the individual authorities, to make their views known to the GLA and to the central government. But the balance right between GLA, Mayor, London boroughs, is it a workable solution, do you think, or not?
Well, it's a really interesting question, because I think the mayoral election that is ongoing is accidentally touching on that precise question. So, for example, when a candidate says something like, I think, you know, we should have a target of X thousand houses, or the mayor should intervene on setting rents, or some of these things that, you know, the mayor can reasonably deliver within the existing rules, others might require legislative change. However, they all have buried within them the implication that the mayor gets the boroughs to do something which either they're not doing now, or do more of something they're doing now. And all I'd say is that the evidence of the history of the boroughs is this has to be done with care. Mm-hmm. Because one of the reasons that the GLC was abolished is that there was a campaign to abolish it long before Mrs. Thatcher's government decided to do it. And the seeds of the abolition had to do with the GLC's efforts to effectively require outer London boroughs to take more housing, particularly more housing of people moving from poor areas in inner London to outer London, move them out into the outer boroughs, which the outer boroughs were often not very keen about.
Yep.
And it sowed tiny seeds of concern in outer London about the operation of the GLC, which became a bigger oak later on. And you can see, however, therefore, that the question of whether the mayor needs more power, I think the answer will be, on occasion, yes, the mayor will need more power. For example, to drive through big developments, particularly big housing developments, which individual boroughs, because their populations respond adversely, individual boroughs don't want. I mean, there are occasions when it does look to me as if, you know, boroughs probably think something should go ahead, but the population doesn't want it, so it gets appealed up to City Hall, then the mayor gives it planning permission, and at some level, both the mayor and the boroughs do get what they want.
Yes.
And the mayor can take decisions that boroughs can't.
And particularly, I suppose, I mean, you say this in the book and you've talked about this earlier on, particularly in locations, I think, which are at the boundaries of authorities. King's Cross is a great example. But also you talk about the South Bank, which is obviously at the, you know, at the northern edge of Southwark and Lambeth, and was historically ignored in many respects because it wasn't near the centre of power. This is a kind of interesting issue there about, you know, the role in specific locations almost, which are not priorities for boroughs themselves, and how it then deals with that.
There's no doubt that the realities of politics mean that the edges of boroughs, and again, this will be true, you know, on the, as it were, the Tameside, Manchester, Stockport border as well. You know, it's just a reality of politics that borough boundaries are often underdeveloped compared with the centre of the authority.
Yeah.
But that means that when the market's motoring and when there's a need for land, those areas that were previously underdeveloped suddenly become available as juicy chunks of prime real estate for massive development. So surprise, surprise, in London today, along a number of the borough boundaries, are the prime development sites. Mm. So, you know, you mentioned King's Cross, but if you look at Battersea, Nine Elms, that's on the Wandsworth-Lambeth border.
Yes.
It's in both boroughs.
Yeah.
The area in inner southeast London around the Elephant and Castle is on the Lambeth-Southwark border.
Yeah.
And all over the city, you see these borders, which are available for development precisely because they were underdeveloped earlier, because they were on boundaries.
Yeah, no, quite. I want to come back to an issue you raised earlier on, which was this emergence of the new urban left, or the new left, predominantly in the bigger cities, London, but also Liverpool, Sheffield and Manchester, etc. and you said, you sense they were very much at loggerheads philosophically as well as practically with central government of the day. But you talk about in the book that having lost that argument, really, that has an enduring legacy for the way that the modern leaders of Hackney or of Newham or of Lewisham or whatever it may be, and indeed of Manchester, but most particularly Manchester, but also Liverpool and Sheffield, how they behave and therefore how we could expect them to behave if they were given some more responsibilities and powers in the way that you and I and others have advocated. So just tell us a little bit about that legacy and how you see that play out in today.
I mean, think about the New Left, which did get a powerful grip, and it controlled a number of London boroughs, and indeed, famously, you know, in a very different form, it must be said, in Liverpool. Militant in Liverpool was different. Quite. But other city councils outside London to different degrees. I mean, some of the issues that they majored on at the time, you know, to do with race equality or gender equality or gay rights, these are things which would, you know, today be seen not only as kind of mainstream, but actually, in some ways, the political system's caught up with those
Indeed.
Ideas.
Yeah.
However, the same enthusiasms on the part of those councillors also, in many cases, led to poor administration to the point of failed councils.
Yes.
That was
yeah.
the trouble.
Yeah.
That somehow these things, that the very desire to treat people better somehow translated it through to not very good management and public services. And, you know, famously, councils like Lambeth and Hackney ended up in a very, very bad place in terms of their public administration. Mm-hmm. And it took years to get that back. But the people who got it back learned. And so the kind of hard-edged Labour councillors you often see these days, and not only in the leadership roles, are people who understand what happened and will just don't want that to happen again. It's not to say they don't have progressive values or don't want to do things that are different from Conservatives. Of course they do. But they are hyper-pragmatic.
Mm.
So they welcome development. They are happy to work with the private and voluntary sector to deliver services. And they kind of believe in a sort of let's just do what works approach while still keeping their, you know, underlying centre-left progressive values. I mean, the other thing, of course, is that the Conservative Party and the right has changed to some degree.
Yes.
It has shifted on these social issues much nearer to that left position. So there are some areas of politics which are much less divisive than, you know, the idea of the loony left, as it was called. You know, it's harder to apply to particular social views today in a way that it might have been 30 years ago. But the impact on the urban leaderships of particularly some Labour councils of this period is still visible. It's built into the DNA of councillors who now just, and this is highly relevant at the moment, you know, as the Corbyn surge and momentum either does or doesn't have an impact on the Labour Party, you know, you can here and there see people just wondering what effects this is going to have on these Labour councils. All the evidence I've seen so far is that there isn't going to be some radical shift, let's put it that way. I think that the impact of the wars, the ideological and culture wars of the late 70s and the 80s have fed through into the way in which councils are now governed, to the point where, you know, this is, you know, you need Alice in Wonderland, Charles Ledwidge Dodgson to explain many of these things. You know, a number of London boroughs, Labour-controlled London boroughs, are going to keep a council tax freeze at the point when the government, a Conservative government, is encouraging them to put up the council tax to pay for adult social care.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
no,
read
no,
into
quite.
That what you can.
Yeah, no, quite. As we begin to come to a close, I get your thoughts on what next. I mean, I think in the book you're both slightly surprised but also very heartened that the boroughs have lasted for 50 years. As you think, you make the point GLC didn't get anywhere near that, not even half, I don't think. We're heartened that they've been around for 50 years in the present and the original form. What does that mean? Do we think that there's reform in the offing just because it's their turn, or do you think not? And I suppose there's also a question about, touching it earlier on, about reform to the GLA, which then may have an effect, a knock-on effect on what the boroughs do or don't do. But what do you see next for the boroughs? Is it more of the same or something different?
Well, you know, against the backdrop of the fact that in modern times, governments in the United Kingdom have only ever reorganised local government one way, i.e. towards fewer authorities, and that, you know, there's been a reorganisation in Northern Ireland very recently. Ministers in Wales are looking at merging authorities. Yes. And, you know, every now and again there are bouts of discussions about whether districts and counties could merge in England, as some of them already have. Why shouldn't there be a reorganisation of London government? I mean, and indeed, by the way, you know, when Ken Livingstone was mayor of London, he would regularly advocate moving to five pizza slice London boroughs. So you have to say they would each of them have, you know, with London's population now approaching 9 million, you know, they'd be as big as Leeds and Birmingham added together, each of these five boroughs. And I'm not sure that would be very local.
No.
You know, and the London boroughs, although there seem to be a lot of them, 32 plus the city, 33 authorities in total, of course, by international standards, these are among the largest municipalities in the known world.
Yeah.
They are very big.
Yeah.
And some of them will soon have 400,000 people living in them, which makes them bigger than Barnet or Croydon. You know, will be bigger than many cities elsewhere in Britain. So, with all of that in mind, and anyway, nobody can ever prove that reorganisations make any difference or improve very much. You know, my instincts are always to kind of to leave things alone, not because you couldn't occasionally improve government by reorganisation. If everybody wants it, well, who's to disagree?
Yeah.
But just doing it for its own sake, or saying, well, 33 seems a big number, why wouldn't, you know, 27 or 14 be a better number? I just, you know, I can't personally see where there's evidence of a failure that would lead to the need for such a reform. And more to the point, you know, we've seen from the tri-borough arrangement involving Kensington and Chelsea, Hammersmith and Fulham and Westminster, that three boroughs, including when one of them changes political control, can work together across boundaries to deliver public services in a way that drives down costs, delivers efficiency, but without removing the democratic separateness of them. So, you know, more my instincts are not to have too many reorganisations.
Yeah. And does that apply for the GLA as well?
I mean, the GLA, I mean, your question earlier about the balance of powers is never going to go away. And I think the more London grows, population-wise, GDP-wise, the question of whether the GLA might need slightly more power every now and again to drive through big changes will be inevitably on the agenda.
Yeah.
That's not to say there needs to be some big rebalancing between the two. I just think, you know, the bigger a city is in terms of population and density, the more you have to think about how do we deliver the kind of big change that's needed.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, again, going back to what the discussions in other city regions outside London now, you can see that as their economies grow, you know, the question of whether the mayor and the metropolitan districts within those areas will always agree on things. You know, there will be disagreements and there's a legitimate room for disagreement.
No, quite.
Because of these different local and metropolitan needs.
Yeah. And of course, I suppose that in terms of the balance of power, there's a bigger issue around the balance of power between London, Greater London, and central government. That's a real big issue for us in terms of the relative power and responsibility that London has, the boroughs and the GLA, vis-a-vis the central government.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, London's population today is nearly 8.75 million. So it's, you know, it's a population bigger than Scotland and Wales added together. Its economic output is over a fifth, nearly 20 to between 20 and 25% of the country, depending on how you measure it, which is simultaneously sort of slightly shocking for many people. But on the other hand, it does mean that if you're saying, well, Scotland and Wales can have income tax raising powers, as the government has, you know, why couldn't London? It could much more easily pay for itself than Scotland or Wales if it were given those powers. But that in turn then begs the question about whether you could radically devolve more power to a city like London, or indeed, you know, to Greater Manchester or Leeds City region or the West Midlands City region, all of which have pretty big GDP, you know, outputs per head and in total. whether a mayoral system of government would always be the right way forward, given that in Scotland and Wales you've got a classic parliamentary type system. So I think once you radically, if you were radically to increase the powers of London's government in total, you know, that would begin to beg questions about whether the whole government system needed to be looked at again.
My guest today has been Tony Travers. Thanks very much, Tony.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by the Centre for Cities. We're an independent, non-partisan think tank dedicated to understanding and improving city economies. For more on our research and events programme, including our extensive back catalogue, please visit our website, centreforcities.org.